This podcast is brought to you by Villanova University on iTunes U. Please visit us on itunes.villanova.edu.
Welcome to Sports Law. Welcome to my class. Welcome a Sports Law. There's probably some fancy name for this class, but I call it Sports Law. Like advanced topics in something, right? Okay. Whatever that is, it's Sports Law. I'm Andrew Brandt. I know some of you. Some of you know me. Some of you know me beyond Villanova, which is fine. What I've tried to do here in my 3.5 years is really bring a, for lack of a better word, a special tone in sports to Villanova Law. There are sports programs around the country, as you know, and those of you who are into sports probably looked at these. And not naming any names, but I don't think any of them has what I bring, which is a practitioner background, someone who's been involved in sports in a lot of different ways, as an agent many years, as a very unsuccessful, terrible professional athlete, and as a team executive, and now the past 6 years, or 5 years, go ahead. As I said in my email, kind of creating something that I really wanted when I left the Packers, which is sort of a life in media and academia that I think, I hope, I try every day to be out there among all the people doing it. My life's a little scattered. You know, I just outside here did radio about this Joey Boza and the Chargers and ran back in here. So it's a great life for me. I'm blessed. And what I want to do in this class and in my role in the university in general, not just law school, is really provide a guide, provide someone that hopefully can be a role model. We talk about role models. We will in this class a lot in terms of athletes, but role model in terms of practitioner, an academician, a broadcaster, a former agent, a former team vice president, that can really be a guide, someone for you guys to look up to and say, these are ways you can get into sports. These are ideas where sports can be a career, where you can, like me, combine your passion with your vocation. That's rare in life. It's hard when you're young. I get it. I get it. You don't just walk into careers like this. You have to find your way, and I'm sure everybody's tired of hearing right place, right time. You're going to hear that throughout. But you can find your way through different ways and through just working hard and being in the right place when opportunity does knock. The way to create opportunity is to prepare, and that is this. That is this class. That is every class you can take in this area. That is working with our sports center, which we're trying to make an umbrella that encompasses classes, the Morehead Sports Journal, Sports and Entertainment Society, Morehead Fellows, around campus. We're very involved with athletics, Department of Athletics as well, and all these other classes around the university that are involved in sports. That is what I'm going to do today is, you don't have to worry about cases. I'm going to talk a lot about myself. I'm sorry. Because I want to give you right away that background. Some of you heard it, and I apologize. You'll hear it again. And sort of where I came from as a law student, even before a law student, into becoming the career that I've had. And that can hopefully be instructional, and it can hopefully be a learning tool for you to sort of see the path, and it's circuitous. It's a lot of ups and downs, a lot of twists and turns, a lot of doors closing, and maybe an opening. So that's what I'm going to talk about that today. It won't take the whole 2 hours. It'll take some time. And then I'm going to ask each of you to do the same. I don't expect 40 minutes from each of you. But why you're here, what's your interest, what's your sports experience, and what's your sports interest and your interest beyond law school. So we can talk about that as well. And then we'll get into the first topic, which will take us probably the first 3 or 4 weeks which is something in the news every day, which is commissioner power in sports. More than commissioner power, this whole idea of moral integrity in sports, which has really become the issue in sports the past 5 years. Where do we want our players to represent? What is the dispute level between players and the management side? Everything we talk about in this class, it's law, right? There's a dispute. There's a dispute. And in 95% of the cases, it's a dispute between someone on the player side, usually a player, or a union, and someone on the management side, usually an owner, a team, or more likely a league, or even a named commissioner. We've seen a lot of that, right, in football. So this is what this class is. It's disputes about rights of players versus rights of owners, leagues, teams, commissioners. And we live in a society in America today where there is a tremendous amount of money coming into sports, primarily from broadcast. And in the bigger sports, I know we're going to talk about a lot of sports here, from minor sports, but millions of dollars for minor sports, tens of millions of dollars for mid-major sports, hundreds of millions of dollars for major sports, and billions of dollars for the top four sports. So the question becomes in sports law and sports business and sports study is, what happens to it? And when there's a lot of money, you know what happens, there's lawyers. And when they're lawyers, you gotta figure it out. Where is this money going? Why isn't it going to more on one side than the other? And how do we resolve disputes about it? Because ultimately it always does come down to money and it comes down to rights. So we're gonna take a historical look through the course of how these disputes were resolved. Again, between players and commissioners, between players and leagues, between players and owners, between unions and leagues. That's where it comes down to. And I'll say this about sports law. Sports law is all law. I'm biased, but it's the most interesting course in law school by far. Why? Because it's sports. It's interesting. It's fun. Everyone's an athlete, right, in their own mind. And number two, it's everything else you study is intertwined in sports. Antitrust law, big sports topic. A lot of antitrust. Talking about leagues, monopolies, yes. Labor law, it's labor law. It's rights of employees who happen to be athletes versus employers who happen to run leagues or teams or sporting entities. It's contracts, obviously. Sports is contracts, period. That's all, it's based on contracts. It's immigration law, especially in hockey and baseball. It's broadcast law. It's communications. It's intellectual property, obviously. My first part of my career, I worked for Michael Jordan's agent. I just sat there all day looking at unauthorized uses of Michael Jordan's name or likeness. Had enough to fill a day. All these areas of law are sports law. And I talk amongst our leadership here at the law school, like, should we give out one of these certificates in sports law? Because that seems to, you know, other schools are doing that. And then I realize what they're doing is they have one or two classes in sports law, and all these other courses I just mentioned, they throw them in there. And they give you a sports law certificate. We could do that. We got more sports law courses than any of those schools. But they throw in all labor and antitrust and contracts. Well, yeah. It's all sports law. So half your curriculum, you now have earned sports law. By the time you hit your third year, you've done half your curriculum is probably sports law. It's just not called sports law. But it all intersects. It really does. So I just think we are in a time and place where this is such a key area because it's all changing. It's all changing. I mean, an obvious example, when I gave my first class last year, I had to miss it. We started a day late because Tom Brady had just won his case. I was up at ESPN talking about this is the end of the NFL in terms of commissioner power because Brady won. Judge Berman said the NFL was wrong. It's not suspended. Well, here we are a year later. And it all changes so fast. And that's why we're going to talk about book and assignments, but I think some of this is going to be like, we'll plan on something one week and then something will blow up. There's huge stories today about the change of daily fantasy right now. That's a new topic. It's changing in front of our eyes. I know there's some players in here, absolutely, I'm sure there are. It's all changing. We had our symposium, as all of you know, last year about this topic. And that symposium in April probably is different than what's going on today. Every subject has changed. So again, I can't speak to all other classes in law school, but it seems to me that when you take contracts or torts or property, you're studying the same thing if you were a law student 20 years ago that you are today, and you will as a law student in 20 years. That's clearly not sports. Changed last year, changed this year, changed next semester. It changes fast. What is changing? Rights of players, rights of owners, rights of intercollegiate athletes, rights of amateur athletes. Beyond all the Olympic stories, there was a story going on about ability to athletes to tweet, social media, to tweet that wasn't involved, that were not Olympic brands, their own brands. This was all going on. Sports law was happening. Beyond all the doping and the court of arbitration, all the real sports law stuff, there are a lot of issues with Rule 40 and Olympic athletes. We'll talk about Olympic sports. We'll talk about intercollegiate sports changing by the day. A lot of you know Vince Nicastro was with me last year. He was the athletic director here for 15 years. He retired as athletic director, told me he never wanted to be an athletic director again, and I got him. I had him. And then he said he got a job. I couldn't turn down. I said, you said you'd never be an athletic director again? He goes, I'm not. I'm going to be COO of the Big East. So I tried negotiating against him to see if there's any way I could keep him. Then I realized, no, I can't do that. I can't compete with that job. Then I negotiated for him as his agent with the Big East, trying to get him a better deal. But I mentioned Vince because he's still going to teach for us. That was part of the deal next semester. I don't think any school has an experienced AD who hired Jay Wright, who started this whole thing, teaching a class. And he'll continue to do that as the deputy commissioner, COO of the Big East. And he'll be part of this class. One day he'll come in and be a guest. So we have that. I'll bring in guests, of course. I don't want to make it too guest-oriented because we could do that. And here's the real challenge I have in teaching. Every year, every student wants something that probably I shouldn't do, which is for me to stand up here entire semester and tell stories. I get it. That's easy. It's fun. You don't have to work that hard. Enjoy it. Like I do on radio or whatever. But I can't do that. Got to teach the stuff, the historical stuff, the context, the law, the cases and materials that we talk about in sports law. And, as I said in my email, weave in my personal experiences. That's the value. That's what we'll be doing. Okay, we got a healthy group. Again, sports, you'll see it from me, I'll see it from you, I hope. Sports is raw. It is really raw. It is one of the things that is kind of a basic instinct of humans. We are emotional about sports. And it's great. It draws out things in people. I walked by a construction site the other day. There's a guy in a business suit talking to a worker. What do you think they're talking about? Sports. I don't know, complaining about Eagles or Phillies, whatever they do. But it's that common denominator. It really is. It ties people together. And as I joked a few minutes ago, everyone thinks but for some coach or knee injury, that'd be me. That'd be me. That was me. And that was me. You know, complaining for 10 years why I wasn't the hottest guy out there. So with that, I'll sort of go into my background. And feel free to ask questions along the way, and then I'll hear from you, and then we'll start into one of the areas we'll talk about. My background, the sport I grew up in was tennis. Growing up not far from here, Washington, D.C. area. And I played, it was different back then. There weren't the Bollettieri's, there weren't the IMG's. You didn't go to Florida, you didn't go to a system, you just played tournaments from your house. And I got pretty good juniors along the Mideast, along the Atlantic Coast, and then one year I actually got to Nationals, went to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I was playing up because I had a bad birthday, and I played a guy 2 years older named John McEnroe. So like this was I was 16 years old. I'm playing John McEnroe. Now McEnroe was not a name. You know, you grow up any sport you're in, you know who the real studs are, right? He was not a name. Never heard of McEnroe. So I'd gotten like the third round of Nationals, which I was over the moon about. I was like, wow. And I draw this kid named John McEnroe, and he comes out and he's fat. He's fat. I'm like, I got this guy. He's fat. He's a chubby kid. And he's got the floppy hair and the headband. And at that time, you could have a guest on the court. He had his mother sitting on the court. So I'm playing Macaro in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Fat kid. So I come out and I'm warming up. And I realize, oh my God. I've never seen anything like this. If you look at a tennis magazine like a Nadal or Federer or whoever, you're just looking at the ball. Like when the ball hits the strings, that eye focus is right there, right there. Steady as can be. McEnroe, lefty, comes out and he's hitting like this. He's looking at his mother, he's looking here, and I'm like, what is going on with this guy? His brothers I know too, they had that. It's a gift, it's hereditary, it's genetic. They have this incredible ability, hand-eye coordination. So that was one thing, got me a little freaked out, this chubby kid. And then I see him serve, and he, as you know, he's got this corkscrew, all the brothers do too. And he turns, so I'm there, and he has his back to me when he's about to serve. And I'm like, whoa. I think I returned 4 or 5 serves, all match. All match. I'd never seen a serve like this. So I didn't win a game. I didn't win a game. I was gone. I continued to play, and I followed McEnroe a few years later to Stanford. Now, he went 1 year, won the championship, NCAAs, and off to Wimbledon. Of course, he was full scholarship. I was 1/16th scholarship. Now, Stanford is great because what they do, I don't think they do this, I don't know if they do this like in swimming and other sports, but on tennis, they kept like 60 guys on the women's tennis. So guys like me could say, I'm playing for Stanford tennis. I never played. I mean, what they had was an A team that played against Cal and USC, UCLA. They had a B team, played against Oregon and Arizona, and the C team against Washington State. I was like on the G team. I was on the H team. We did play against like a couple of these schools' JVs. We played against Nevada Reno. Played against Humboldt, Eureka College. If you've heard any of these. But I did play. But anyway, the point is, here we are at a high level, and we're watching all the good players play every week. But it was so intense, and this is back to that athletic thing. I'm like, we got to try this. We got to try this. So me and some guys at the end of the bench, we are going to try this. And what I mean by this is we're going to try to play professional sports. And this is what professional sports really is, beyond what you see on TV. This is what it is. So me and three guys, we are traveling the ATP satellite circuit just trying to get points. A tournament would start on Monday. I'd usually lose by Tuesday at the latest, or maybe Wednesday. Then I'm off to the next site. We would wash our socks in the sink every night. We would stay two to a bed. We would travel. Sometimes families would take us in. We would stay in wherever we could stay. I'm living in places going from Killeen, Texas, to Lake Charles, Louisiana, to Lafayette, Louisiana, to DeLand, Florida, to Panama City. I mean, wherever. And you're just trying to get points. So maybe you could get into a bigger tournament. Now listen, we're calling our own lines. We're using used balls sometimes. And maybe three people are in the stands. Girlfriends. Or some schmuck that just showed up. That was my experience with professional sports right there. That was it. So anyway, I lasted 6 months. I made it as high as I think 2850 in the world. Somebody's got to be 2850. And I moved on. What did I do when I didn't know what else to do? I went to law school. When I say I moved on, I have to tell this story because 7 or 8 years later, I'm an agent. I'm recruiting a kid at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. I'll never forget this day in my life because when I opened the school newspaper, it said tonight at the pavilion, at school pavilion, the satellite circuit is in town. And I'm like, I played on that. I'm like, I'm going. And here's what just stays with me to this day, and having dealt with Brett Favre and so many athletes that people say, hang on. These are the same guys. I go out there, the same guys. 7, 8 years later, so instead of being 23, they're 30. 22, they're 29, 30. Same guys. And it just struck me, oh my God, you're right. I mean, this is sports. I gave it up, but they didn't. And these guys, we go out for beers after, and I say, what are you doing? And they look at me and they say, what are you doing? Why aren't you still playing? And I said, I had to move on. I was making like $6,000 a year. And now these guys, instead of ranked 2,000, they're ranked, I don't know, 300, 400 maybe, making $35,000, $40,000, $45,000. But staying in crappy hotels and paying their expenses. I mean, so I said, and then we had this conversation, same conversation I have about Brett Favre all the time. Like, why give it up? Because you're only going to be elite for so long. And this is a conversation you have often with people that just sort of don't want to enter the real world. I get it. But it was just a poignant night talking to these guys. They barely remembered me. I was just around for a few months. But I'm like, yeah, I played with you. Oh, yeah, yeah, small guy, ran down everything. But no power, that's me. So it's hard to give up. I get it. I really get it. And I gave it up because I thought there was more to my life than hanging around being a really bad athlete at that level. So, went home to Georgetown Law School. And what was fortunate for me while in law school was there was a big firm in DC, no longer there, called ProServe. ProServe represented a lot of athletes, and at that time represented a lot of tennis players. So they knew me a little bit from growing up as a top junior in the area. I certainly knew them, and I was able at least to get a meeting. And when I went in there, I talked to them, and here's my hook. I mean, I'm coming in as a kid. They're, you know, they see tons of people wanting to be interns. And I said, here's what I can do. I can at least get you two Stanford tennis players, you know, one of the top programs in the country. I can't sign the kids. I don't have that. But I can get you to them. And that was enough to get me an unpaid internship, to just get me in the door. And then I started working as in the tennis area while in law school. And even when I got to the end of law school, third year, I'm doing all the putting on the suit and doing the interviews, but I had an opportunity to stay at ProServe. And then I got the offers from the what I call real law firms. And that was a tough decision. Even as a 26-year-old kid, where everyone's saying, of course you'd rather hang around with athletes than stuffy lawyers. Yeah. But I had to realize, if I'm going to make that choice, I'm probably, and this has turned out to be true, I'm probably moving away from being a lawyer. Maybe the rest of my life. Because when you move to sports, sorry about that. I don't know who that is. When you move to sports, you get more business. You're more entrepreneurial. You're representing athletes. You're doing marketing deals. You're working on contracts, but it's not sophisticated legal work. And that was okay with me. So I gave up a lot of money, and I stayed in the sports track rather than what I call the real lawyer track. And I began as a tennis agent. And when you're a tennis agent, what you're doing is you're recruiting 13-year-olds. You're down at the Orange Bowl and you're looking at kids. Because if you don't get them then, they're taken. So what I did then was, and when you're dealing with that, you're really dealing with parents, right? So you're really dealing with tennis parents, and they're no peach, you know? I'm one now. All right? We're not easy. Because every parent, no matter the sport, no matter anything, thinks their kid is the end of the world. I get it. But it's tough from an agent point of view. And it just got to me, it got to the point where I was burned out on tennis, burned out playing tennis, burned out watching tennis, burned out dealing with tennis players. And I had an opportunity, because what I did was I saw this big sports firm. And I saw down the hall this guy, David Falk, and he's dealing with football and basketball players, primarily basketball. And he needed help. It just looked to me like he had all these athletes and he didn't have a lot of help. So I went to the firm leadership and I said, listen, I'm happy here. I love it. But can I move away from tennis into that area? And they looked at it, saw the need, they said, okay. I'm like, cool. So for the next 6 years of my life, I was representing football and basketball players. David Falk, he was here last year. Hope you all got to see him. The premier agent in basketball, known, of course, mostly for Michael Jordan. But we probably had 40 guys in the NBA, and I got to work with some of them. And I'll tell stories along the way of some of these fun experiences I had. My favorite kid was this Muggsy Bogues, who's this high, who was my client. We hung out together. He was the only guy I could ever see eye to eye with in my history of sports. Him and Darren Sproles I met the other day. I'm like, wow, there's some Lilliputians around. So anyway, what was the opportunity for me was David had some interest, but not a lot, compared to basketball, in football. We had a few football players. I could build that. that was, I looked at that and I said, wow, that's an opportunity. Football. I'm a huge fan. I'm going to be a football agent, because that's what David didn't care so much about, football. And he was so tied up with Michael and Iverson, Alonzo Mourning and Pat Ewing and all these guys. Like, I'm going to deal with football. And I built up a practice, obviously with his help and the gravitas of the firm. By the time I was leaving, I had maybe 18, 20 NFL guys. Mid-90s, early 90s, I'm doing a contract with the Minnesota Vikings for one of our best clients in football, a guy named Chris Dolman. He's now in the Hall of Fame. And after we're done with the contract, this owner of the Vikings, or GM, looks at me up and down, like, why is he looking at me like that? He says, do you speak Barcelonan? I said, what's that, Spanish? He said, yeah, Spanish. Turns out it wasn't. It's not Spanish. They speak Catalan. It's another story. I said, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, yeah, I took it in high school. I speak. He said, how'd you like to be the general manager of the Barcelona Dragons? I said, what's that? We're starting a new league. It's going to be overseas. It's going to be great. Introducing football around the globe. It's amazing. You know, he sounded like Trump. It's just amazing. I said, okay. Do you have any jobs in this country? No. We're heading overseas. Remember he said rock and roll GMs. We want some young guys, shake it up, selling football around the world. So again, here I am, been with players. You'll see this pattern throughout my career. I've been on the player side a long time. I've got an opportunity to move to the management side. And I'm young and single, and I'm like, wow, I can run a team. I can put together a team. Now, it was hard to leave all these clients, really hard. But I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And I accepted the job of the first GM of the Barcelona Dragons. And consider this, I had no players, no staff, no coaches, and I'm moving to a country that had no idea what American football was, and I can say today, still doesn't. So I had to take a deep breath and realize, what the hell did I just do? Then I say to the guys, what do I do? The NFL guys, what do I do now? Well, hire a coach. Who do I hire? Well, talk to some of these hot NFL assistants. Who? There's this guy, Pete Carroll, talk to him. Tony Dungy, you'll like him. Norv Turner. This was a while ago. I talked to all of them. They're like really intrigued, especially Dungy, like, this is really cool. But no. No, I'm not going to Spain. I want a career in the NFL. I'm not going to Spain. I'm like, all right, I get it. I get it. Boston College fires their coach. Jack Bicknell, at the exact same time this is happening. For those of you, you remember Doug Flutie, we had those great years, and then they had a tailspin, so they fired him. I go up to Boston, I meet this guy, Bicknell, love him. Just a grandfatherly father figure. I think he's going to be great. He'll be relaxed about some of the challenges we'll face over there. And plus, he'll recruit a lot of good BC players. So I say, you're hired. He says, great. He says, I got a staff. I got assistant coaches. They're all out of work. I said, hired. You want to meet them? No. No. I don't have time for that. Hired. I got trainers, video guys. Yep, hired. Hired. You want to meet them? No. No, we're moving. Go to Florida. They bring in 1,000 players. All these are sort of NFL training camp cuts from the year before or 2 years before. We poke them, we prod them, we test them, we wonderlick them, we drug test them, we interview them. I don't know who to pick. I ask friends in the NFL, who do I pick? They tell me who to pick. I pick. Picked 80 players. Our first pick went to Temple. Paul Palmer, running back. Heisman Trophy runner-up at one point. So we have this team of 80 players. We then have training camp in Florida for 7 days. We just introduced each other, 7 days, and then we got to cut to 40. So we tell 40 of the 80, they're not coming to Spain, some of whom were Spanish. I hired a bodyguard, security. This was hard. We get on the plane, 40 guys, 10 coaches, instant football team. We put it together in 2 weeks, a team. We get to Spain. Our marketing guy comes to the plane. He says, Andrew, he tells us all, he says, I want to tell you we have sold for the opening night 173 tickets. I said, well, how many does it hold? 40,000. That's not good. It's okay. Why is it okay? In Spain, they walk up. Everyone walks up. I'm like, that's a hell of a lot of walk up. Yeah, we walk up. Okay. I said, no, that's not good. We got it. We got to do something. So besides handing out tickets on every street corner, the best thing we did, the best marketing I've ever done in my whole life was then, because what I did was I got a meeting with the general manager of Football Club Barcelona, one of the great brands of all of sports. They're playing the night before our game. They're playing in front of 110,000 people. 110,000 people, full. And I got a meeting, and I went in there with our translator, and I said, listen, what do you guys do at halftime? What do you mean? What do you do at halftime? What do you mean? What do you do at halftime? What do you mean? What do you do when they go in and before they come out? What do you do? They smoke cigarettes. What do you do on the field? Can we go out there and can we run around, throw the ball, kick the ball, wear our helmets, and have the announcers say tomorrow night at Montjuic Stadium? He looks, his people are all worried about the field. I'm like, we'll wear tennis shoes. We'll wear socks, whatever. And then he said to one of them, we still smoke? Yes, smoke. So we got it done. We get out there in our full regalia. We throw the ball. We kick the ball. We have the announcers say tomorrow night, Montjuic Stadium, Barcelona Dragons. And I think he said that. And then the next day, despite a monsoon, which is really unfortunate, 18,000 people walked through that door. Now, I probably gave out like 6,000 tickets. But I told the NFL, we told the NFL, we're going to get you 15,000. We are. We are. We're going to get you 15,000. That was their number. And we had 18. Now, then I got to worry about the product, right? Here's the problem. I've been working on the product. The first half, the product's pretty squirrely. I mean, we look bad. So did they. It's like junior high school football here. I mean, it was bad. Second half, we pulled together. First drive, we hit our tight end on a seam pattern. He breaks three tackles, 60 yards. Touchdown. I'm jumping up and down, and the whole crowd is polite. Golf applause. There's no noise. No noise. So then our kicker goes and kicks the extra point, and they go nuts. The crowd went nuts. The crowd erupted with the extra point. And I looked around, oh my God. And then I realized the entire game and the next games, they're cheering at the wrong times. They're cheering at all the wrong times. They're doing the wave the entire game long. They do the Olé song the entire game long. And they do it from start to finish. And they are paying no attention to what's going on the field. They don't get it. So I had a fan committee, and we met with them once a month, and they just kept saying the same thing. Andrew, stop with the meetings. What do you mean the meetings? Stop meeting. What meeting? You run a play, then you meet. Stop meeting so much. I said, well, they're called huddles. No meetings. And I would go to our coaches and I'd say, they don't want meetings. What the hell does that mean? They don't want huddles. So we don't coach that way. And then he gave me some choice words to tell the fans. I'm like, okay. No meetings. I mean, yes, meetings. They never got it. But here's what we did. We said, listen, and then I'll get off Barcelona in a second. This is what we did. We said, listen, this is what we're going to do. Our whole staff, we brought them in. We had a league person come in because I wanted him to hear it from New York. I said, we are not selling football. Forget it. Forget it. We're not selling touchdowns and running backs and tight. Forget it. They don't care. They don't want to know about football. They know about soccer. But what we're going to sell is we're going to sell 3 hours in America, and they're going to have a ball. So we hired marching bands, thousands of pounds of hot dogs and hamburgers. We blasted rap music. We blasted every kind of American music. I hired two Miami Dolphin cheerleaders to come teach these women how to dance like that. Las Chicas del Dragons. They were booked everywhere. Around the whole country they were booked. So we made it a party. And then the best thing, and if you're ever considering entertainment for sporting events, these dogs, love the dogs. The Frisbee dogs, we use them before, during, after. We use them with the Las Chicas at every event. $5,000 a dog for the whole season. They were great. They crapped all over the hotel, but they were great. I am a fan of Frisbee dogs for life because people love it and it's cheap. Anyway, I lasted 2 years. We lasted 2 years. The NFL World League, first iteration of NFL overseas, folded, came back later as NFL Europe, folded, came back later as NFL Europe 2, folded, and now the NFL, as we'll talk about, has streamlined its efforts overseas with London, and not one, not two, but three London stadiums, and I think that will increase. But I'll give you my thoughts on NFL International as we go through it. I came back to the States. The NFL was very generous with us when it was suspended, and I had an opportunity, and I got back. Here's my life again, back and forth, got back into the labor side. I got back into the agent business. I moved to Boston, Mass, because a big firm went through some changes. A pioneer in the agent business is a guy named Bob Wolf. And way back in the day, Bob represented Magic and Larry Bird and Flutie and all these great athletes, a lot of them from Boston area, but all over. Bob tragically died of a sudden heart attack. I guess this was in the mid-90s, late 90s, and his firm was passed along to his wife, who had no interest in running a sports firm. So she sold to a big group in Boston, and they hired people to come run the firm in different areas. So they came to me when this happened, and I decided to do that. I went back into the agent side, moved to Boston, worked for Wolf Associates. We still kept the name without the word Bob, Wolf Associates, and different athlete divisions. The guy running hockey was, for those of you who follow this sport, maybe the biggest name ever, Bobby Orr was running the hockey division. So it was great to work alongside him as well. My time there was really dominated by one player, though, and I signed him as a baseball player. He was playing minor league baseball for the Philadelphia Phillies AA system while being a college student. He was a professional baseball player. You're allowed to do that. Back in the day, John Elway did this from Stanford. You can be a pro baseball player during the summers. His name is Ricky Williams. And Ricky was a running back at University of Texas, at that point still developing, but a minor league baseball player. I had a contact to Rick, and then we became close friends. I became his agent while being a professional baseball player. Then he became this incredible college football player. Now we're talking about his junior year, where he set all kinds of records, and we decided at that time, after the bowl game, that he was going to turn pro. We filled out the paperwork. I had it in my desk, and I just knew Rick was a different cat. So I called him the night before it was due, and I said, we're still going to do this, right? And of course, as history knows, he decided to end against it. He said, I'm going to stay another year at University of Texas. So again, think about my life right then. Now I had a wife and kid, and I had $1 million fee just drop to the ground when he said that, because he was going to be, you know, a top pick and make tens of millions of dollars. I said, "You understand the injury risk?" He says, "Yeah, I get it all." He said, "I love Austin. Next year, I know I have to leave Austin. This year, I don't have to leave Austin." So he was going to be drafted by, I don't know, St. Louis or Chicago. He says, "I don't want to go to St. Louis or Chicago if I don't have to." That's the way he thought. And what could I say? So that led to a year of mine where all I was doing primarily, while trying to represent other clients, I was holding on to what was going to be the watershed client of my career, this incredible asset named Ricky Williams, who was going to be, again, the top pick, highly marketable, first guy with dreads, big time player. I got him. I just got to hold on a year. And that entire year, every big time agent is nipping at my heels saying, "Brant can't do that. He's not big enough. He's a small time agent." But I had him. So I'm going down to Texas. He wins the Heisman Trophy. He wins all these awards. He plays in the Cotton Bowl, and 2 hours later, he signs with me. I got him. So I got Ricky Williams after this two-year courtship. Now, it turns out that once you get a guy like that, you're traveling with a rock star. I didn't know this. I never had a guy like this. So he's being asked to go to everywhere, Japan, Hawaii, the AMAs, the Emmys, the Oscars, the ESPYs, everything. And what do? I go. I was never home. My wife says, "What do you do in all these trips?" I said, "Absolutely nothing. I don't do anything. I'm just there. I'm trying to protect the asset." At some point, I start to see guys hanging around him. And I didn't confront them, and then I realized there's a lot of guys hanging around them that are wearing certain kind of like shirts or jackets. So I confront him. I say, "Rick, what's up? What is this? Who are these guys?" And he says, "They work for Master P." I said, "Who's Master P?" I didn't know. He says, "You don't know?" I don't know. Rapper, music impresario, entrepreneur. Starting a sports firm, and he wants me to be his watershed, his starting client, and I think I want to work with Master P. I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He says, "I want to be with him, and I want you, Andrew, I want you to work with him. You want me with P?" "Yes, I do." He goes, "I like you. I don't like the guys back in Boston. I like you. Why don't you work with P?" I said, I don't know. He says, "Well, just meet him." I said, "All right, I'll meet him." So I meet him. Percy Miller is his name. I know that. And, you know, like, there's music everywhere. There's people everywhere. He's telling me, you know, he's going to represent Rick. He's going to have all these other players, basketball and women's sports and boxers. And I would do the contracts. I'm just like, my head is spinning. But I realized practically, if I go back to Boston without Rick, I'm done there. I'm done. So I'm looking at a real possibility of my life starting with Master P. Because life is about options, right? That was my option. There were not other ones. There were no other ones. And then there was. So the exact same time this is happening, within a day, I keep getting calls from the Green Bay Packers. Now, I had a player there, one player, and he is still a close friend, and he played up until a few months ago, Matt Hasselbeck. Now, Matt was a third-string quarterback. I'm like, what the hell do they call me about a third-string quarterback? And I ignored the calls. And I finally called him back, and I said, "Listen, I can't deal with Hasselbeck right now. I got Master P, I got Ricky Williams." And they said, "We know." It was news. They said, "We know. And we're not calling about Hasselbeck." I said, "Why are you calling me?" They're saying Mike Holmgren, our coach, he just went to the Seattle Seahawks. I said, okay. I watched SportsCenter. I saw. I said, well, he took this guy Mike with him, another Mike. And Mike, that Mike ran the whole business operation of the Packers. Holmgren took him to Seattle. I said, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. And I didn't know where this was going. And they said, well, how'd you like to switch sides? I said, what are you saying? Come to Green Bay. Come to Green Bay, which I had never been to. I said, yeah. And it was this moment like, oh my God, like Green Bay was Packers. And I said, listen, you deal with 100 agents. Why are you calling me? Why me? He said, well, we like, you know, the way you deal with people, have a nice way of dealing with people who seem to know your way around the cap and the contracts. And Hasselbeck, the backstory with Hass is that a lot of teams were trying to get him. I thought it was best for him to stay behind Brett, work in Green Bay, and work with a coach he really liked named Andy Reid, who was a quarterback coach. So I helped that out, and we got contractually benefited from that for a while, too. So anyway, I said, let me come see you. I go up there. You know, I leave Austin, which is like 80 degrees. I go to Green Bay, like 10 degrees. And I am very direct. I said to him, listen, the GM and the president, I said, listen, don't take offense at this question, but do I have to actually move here to do this? Like move to Green Bay, Wisconsin? They said, no offense taken, but yeah, you got to be here. You know, for your position, you got to be here. So again, then wife and a kid, and what we really decided at that time was that we're going to do it. Green Bay is certainly not the most geographically desirable place, but we were going to do it because we wanted to get off the train of chasing players. I did. Just like I wanted to get off, you know, certain points in my life. Everyone asked me at that time, would you be doing this if you had Rick? I called him Rick. That was his given name. And I couldn't answer that, but I will tell you this. Ricky and all these top guys, you know, they could fire you because they don't like the color of your tie one day. And that was something I knew. If it didn't happen then, it could have happened later. So we just decided this will be a different way to look at sports. I'm going to go to the management side, as I'd done before, and I'm going to deal with agents. And so what I did was I went to Green Bay, took my wife another year to move there. She was a teacher, filling out a year. So it was an amazing introduction to see a place like that. And I'm actually going there again on Monday for something. But that community wraps itself around a sports team like no place I've ever seen. And they live it. They breathe it. I mean, you get off the plane at the airport. I see a Dawkins shirt here. You get off the plane at the airport, and half, I'm talking about half the population, is wearing shirts like that. Where, you know, the get-up on Saturday night for women is jeans and a Brett Favre shirt. That's what's the desired look. Now it's Aaron. So it's a unique experience. What I did there for 9.5 years really is this, because I think everyone understands what a coach does, what a scout does, what a trainer does. What I was, my title was Vice President General Counsel, what I've been referred to as capologist, as negotiator, whatever it is. But I think the best way to look at what I did is this. In every sports organization, sports franchise, there's two sides. One is the kind of administrative business side of the organization, and the other is the sports side. So in the administrative business side, I was half that, which is you're looking forward, you're looking out on caps and contracts and futures years ahead. What happens when the collective bargaining agreement expires? What happens if and when Brett retires? How are we preparing for things? How have we put our money away? how much can we invest in this part of the team long term? That's the one side. On the other side of any sports organization, in my case football, it's the GM and the coach, and it's very immediate. Andrew, when can we get this player signed? When can he be on the field? When can you do an injury settlement to get him the F out of here? When can we have him? Can he be on the field for the game? Can we get him signed this week? So it's very immediate. So you're balancing. The best way I described my job was I was the focal point, the fulcrum point between the business side and the football side. And sometimes I'm telling the business side, hey, we need extra here. We need to be more aggressive here. I need $1 million here. We got to get something done. And sometimes I'm telling the sports side, the football side, like, you got to chill, okay? We have spent this much money at running back. We're not getting this other guy for you. You've got to chill on what you want right now. And it was a tough job, but I enjoyed it because it was a way to sort of bring the whole organization together. And that's, in a nutshell, what I did. I think the basic way of describing what I did is I was responsible for the expense side, the largest expense of any sports organization, any level, is labor. It's player costs. So depending on the year, I'm responsible for $100 to $150 million of player costs. And I would set a budget, we'd have a salary cap, and we'd figure out how to handle it. A lot of people always ask me to compare being an agent and working for a team and what I like more about each. I think being an agent is like being a fantasy football owner, right? Because you have guys on different teams and you just want them to do well. You don't care about teams. I mean, you care about teams you grew up following, but you don't care about teams. You care about your players. Just like a fantasy football owner. That's what an agent is. You want to maximize results on your team, your guys. As a team executive, you really care little about individual performance. You're all about team. And I would say that job was more challenging than being an agent because I had a board like that big. And it was all about our team, when their contracts were up, who their agent was, what their age was, what their contract stream looks like, and you had to manage it and decide who you're going to extend, decide who you're going to let go, decide where the pipeline comes in below them. And every action has a reaction when you work for a team because you're dealing with a salary cap system, and if you bring in, usually you have to pull out. So it's a very different look at sports working for a team, which is all about the collective, versus working as an agent. 9.5 years, what I decided, I mean, basically my Green Bay experience, we loved it at the early years because it's so unique. You're treated like royalty when you work for the team, and it's just all encompassing. I mean, I'm pumping gas, and Aaron really gonna be the next quarterback? Yeah. That's ultimately why I felt we had to get out of there, though. Because I don't know about you and your own personal situations, but I like being pretty balanced in life. And it was very, you could not walk out of your house and not talk about the Packers. Imagine a life like that. And it wasn't just me. It was the practice squad players that have radio shows. It's just a unique situation up there. It's very small. You go to the movie theater on Friday night, you see half the team. And it's just this, what I loved about it at the beginning, I just felt like we had to get out of there. I wanted more for my kids. I wanted more for us. I wanted a diverse life. And we hosted the Giants in the championship game, 2009, if you remember. It was Tom Coughlin's face was purple. It was the coldest I'd ever been, and I ever want to be. And we lost on overtime, and it was time. So we moved on. After moving my wife to rural Wisconsin for 10 years, she got to pick the next stop. She's from Villanova, Pennsylvania, like a block from here. So we moved back here. And what I wanted to do, without getting too corny, is I just wanted to create another life. I didn't want to work for a team. I had offers right then. I didn't want to be an agent again. I really enjoyed communication, and that was my major in college. I had a journalism professor who told me that I had a real gift for writing, and I never used it in sports business. So I started writing, started my own website with some guys who had experience in the league, and we called it National Football Post. I got some attention. And what was lucky for me was that I started doing a lot of freebies, what I call, where people bring me on TV to talk about whatever issues are happening in sports business, sports law, primarily NFL. And I hit a time that was perfect. Again, I admit to being very fortunate, because in 2011, every major sports league, football, basketball, baseball, hockey, looked on the horizon and within 6 to 12 months was facing either a strike or a lockout. Every one of them. It was just fortuitous, because these networks looked around and said, who can explain this stuff? And luckily for me, they said, that guy can. So within a couple weeks, I was at the Super Bowl. Our Packers were playing the Steelers in Dallas in the frickin' ice and cold. There's not a plow in Dallas, I learned that. We're slip sliding around the highway. Should have died. It was awful. But anyway, I had three offers. And I chose ESPN. And I was able to get hired by ESPN, and basically at that point they said, you got to explain this to the country. You got to explain what's happening between the NFL and the NFLPA. They can't get an agreement. They're going to go into a lockout. They're going to go into a strike. What the hell is this? I said, cool. I'm all in. And that was why I was hired initially, to be the lockout guy in 2011. And this is where I advise you to just keep pushing. Because what I knew, as soon as I walked in there, I said, this lockout could be over in 4 weeks. And I got to create a role beyond it. So every time ESPN asked me for something, I said, I'm good, I got it. Andrew, can you talk about NASCAR? Absolutely. And I'm thinking in my head, no fucking way. I don't know anything. I don't know anything about NASCAR. But I'm like, yes, damn right I can. Can you talk about college conferences and what's going on there? Thinking in my head, I have no idea. Yes, absolutely. Now, my go-to was obviously NFL, but baseball, sure. Baseball lockout, absolutely. Absolutely. Hockey lockout, I'm in. And luckily, I've been creating this role. And I'm now in year 5 with ESPN. But ESPN's a place where everyone wants to work there. They always have the leverage. You always have to create your worth. That's on the TV side. On the writing side, I was continuing my own website until 2012, when ESPN said, no, we want you to write for us. And that was kind of a condition to being on air. So I had to leave my own website, which I still have an equity interest in, and move to ESPN for the writing. 1 year later, Sports Illustrated, a guy named Peter King, starts a new website and pulls together a band of people to write for it. I'm going to be the business guy, business law guy. And that was I thought that was a much bigger forum than writing for ESPN. So I now had to go to ESPN and say, I love you guys for radio and TV, but I want to write for your biggest competitor. I didn't say it that way. And lo and behold, they allowed it. I think they liked the boost from my writing for the MMQB that Crust promotes. So that's my media side. On the academic side, I started teaching right away at Wharton. I knew a guy, Ken Shropshire, run the sports business part at Wharton, and he definitely wanted me in there. I started with one class, and between 2010 and 12, I went from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 classes a year. And then this place called. So Jeff Moore gave the gift, and I knew Jeff from, he like me, was an agent, then went to a team just like me, but then he advanced into ownership, not like me, and obviously made a killing on a sale of the San Diego Padres. Started endowed this center, and he and Dean Gattanda came to me and said, would you run it? And I said, no. I said, you don't want me? I got ESPN and Sports Illustrated and Wharton. You don't want me. Get someone who's going to be there all the time. Get someone who come an academic. Just get someone like that. And they went away, came back. I mean, the best way to negotiate, obviously, is to say no, but I was lucky. They came back and they said, you know what, you're right. You're right. We don't want an academic. We want someone with a background that can be a guide, as I talked about, for students with your name, with a national voice, and bring you here. And we worked it out. So this has been a great experience for me being here. But you see that everything I've talked about really flows. I think it does. What I've done is sort of build, it's an overused word, but I've built a brand. And hopefully my brand is intelligent and credible sports business and legal information. And that is something that I use here, teaching, television, radio, and digital. Everything I do is flowing together, and that's why I like it, because creating this niche brand, in life, everybody's trying to get you. If you stay the same, you're not moving anywhere. So I'm always trying to create new ways to position things, to talk about things, and have new insights that people don't have. Because what people out there are looking for always is what is different about you. And I tell everyone that's looking for jobs in sports the same thing. Find your special skill. Find what separates you from everyone else trying to get a job. Why are you different? Why should I hire you? What makes you different? What makes you special? What skill do you have that makes my life easier? And that's where it comes down to. What I sell is I've been there and I've been on both sides and no one's done that. And I can speak intelligently and articulately about things that sometimes people don't have a good grasp of. A great skill that I always look for that hopefully I continue to work on is take complex subjects. And there are complex subjects in sports, and break them down into digestible bites. If you can do that, you'll be successful. There's no doubt in my mind. If you can take something that really seems really dense, and you can break it down so people get it, you're golden. I just think that's such a great skill where you see clarity in things where people don't. And listen, I've had TV people say to me, Andrew, you know, you gotta make it a little dumber here. And I said, I'm not gonna make it dumber, but I'm gonna make it clearer, I hope. Because I don't want to underestimate people's intelligence. It's important. So that's a skill. So that's my life. I think what I try to bring like here to this class is all those experiences give me some insights that hopefully you'll get that you wouldn't get from other people. And I'm going to have insights about all these topics that flow into. And when I've been standing on the corner in front of some courtroom the past 2 years about Tom Brady or Ray Rice or Adrian Peterson or Greg Hardy or any of these things, I'm thinking in my mind, okay, what do they need to know? Maybe I'll only have 90 seconds, maybe 60 seconds. What do they need to know? I just sat in a courtroom listening to some lawyers talk about Brady versus the NFL for 4 hours. What do they need to know? And that's not just a skill for TV. That is really something you got to be able to do with anything. Break it down in a way that you can understand it, that you can say, okay, I got that. Hour 20. All about me. All right, let's take a quick break. Sorry. I just get going, you know? That's what this class is going to be, a lot of that too, where I just like, you're going to walk out and say, Brant really got going on that. Yeah. Yeah, I get carried away sometimes. Like I did my latest article, I do a podcast too. This, you know, this Josh Brown thing with the Giants, I'm wild about it. Like, come on. We got to talk about that. Take a quick break, okay? We'll be back soon.